Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode this week in tribute to Dean Whitaker, a remarkable ex-prisoner of war who passed away last week in Las Vegas at the age of 97. Before we're done, we're going to hear from Honor Flight Southern Nevada founder Belinda Morse about how much Dean and his example meant to that organization. One of the stories Dean enjoyed telling about the B-17 that he flew in, Stormy Weather it was called, is one mission when that bomber really lived up to that moniker.
It gets pretty cold up there, and we were flying through some clouds that had snow in them, very moist. And a B-17 is a kind of a rattly airplane as far as comfort concerned. And it gets very cold there. Well, the snow was coming through the cracks of the nose, and it piled up a little bit, and the navigator gathered up a snowball and threw it at me. And to this day, still kids me about having a snowball fight at 28,000 feet.
Not too many people in the world can claim that, I don't think.
No, probably not. It was kind of unusual, but we always kept our sense of humor, and no matter what was going on, we were scared, of course, but we didn't show it.
I'm thinking probably the only other people that have had a snowball at 28,000 feet would be maybe like Sir Edmund Hillary or someone who climbed Mount Everest, huh?
Yes, you'd have to get pretty high and pretty cold to do that.
By the time your 20th mission rolled around on November 2nd, 1944, you had probably gotten into a bit of a groove with your crew, and you guys had found some kind of routine to going up on a mission, coming back, and believing that's the way it was going to work? Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. Our pilot was an older guy. He was really a good man. He was 26 years old, and he was a first lieutenant. He had made first lieutenant in the infantry and got to join the Air Force at a later date. I don't know. He probably had a lot of medals or something to make that. But he was really kind of a religious guy, too. We would always meet under our plane before a mission and everybody say a little silent prayer, and this helped.
I believe it, and I imagine, you know, that's different for every person in the military, but it sounds like maybe that had been a part of your life growing up, that you had some awareness or relationship with God or some kind of belief that was going to help you there?
Yes. My parents were Mormons, and we always had that feeling that if we needed help, it was there.
Well, and I think the story we're about to dive into will certainly show that. Tell me about that mission. You're supposed to bomb Merseburg on November 2nd, 1944?
Yes, their synthetic oil plant at Merseburg was a major target. The Germans were running out of oil in their tanks, and that just didn't have enough to really put out a full effort. And so this target was very special. I think every gun in Germany was at that plant. They'd taken them all from Berlin, and the Air Force was the Luftwaffe. The only place they flew was Merseburg, and it was quite a battle. When I looked ahead and saw the flak, which is the black explosion of 88-millimeter shells going off, I thought, Mike, we're going to be lucky to get through this. We got through it fine. We were hit a few times. All I could tell when you were hit that we could smell the burning hot flak metal going through the ship. And we got out of that fine. And as soon as we were out of that, the Luftwaffe attacked us. The first attack, they always attack from the tail because their 20-millimeter cannon would go further than our 50 caliber machine gun. And so the tail gunner was really busy on that first mission, and I think he shot down one of the planes. One of the fellows said, you got one, over the intercom. And so on the second attack, we were hit really bad. The tail gunner was shot bad, and the waist gunner went back to check on him, and he did. He said, he's dead. By that time, we were hit real bad, and the plane was out of control. The pilot gave the word to bail out, and me being the navigator, right by the nose escape hatch, I was the first one out. On the way, before I could go out, I had to release, I wore what they called a flak suit, armor vest, and I couldn't, there's an escape tag on that that you pull and it's supposed to be released. Well, it didn't release, and I was fighting that, trying to get that off, and I said, man, I got to get out of here. And, you know, I had a voice kind of, my father had passed away about 8 months before I went in the service, and I thought I heard his voice say, you get out of there now. So I did. I wanted to jump out. I said, I can't wait any longer. I jumped out of the escape hatch of the nose. As soon as I hit the slipstream, it tore the flak suit off, but my parachute was only fastened on one side because I couldn't fasten the other side when the flak suit was on. So here I was fighting all the way down, trying to fasten the other side. And at 28,000 feet, you have no strength. You're just ready to pass out. And so I started entering some clouds at 3,000 feet. And I said, well, I better pull this now, whether it's fastened or not. And I pulled it, and I was floating down, and I could hear shots coming up at me. And the Germans were shooting at me as I was coming down.
And this was fire from their aircraft or from the ground?
Well, that was from the ground. It was civilians in the ground were shooting. They all had guns. And the odd thing about this, when I was, before I hit the ground, I could hear cheering. And I thought, who the heck is cheering in the middle of Germany? And I just about landed in a German prisoner of war camp that held English prisoners. And luckily, a guard from this camp come running out of the camp and made the civilians stop shooting me. They had their rifles already aimed at me, and so they stopped shooting. And the guard gathered me up and took me into this camp, and the English prisoners of war gave us tea and crumpets. It was really something. Four members of my crew were not that lucky. They landed too far away for this soldier to save them, and they were killed by the German civilians. And they later paid for it when the GIs came in, and they had a trial, and I have the names of all the soldiers that did that, and I think they were executed for doing that.
Well, that's understandable, and I'm just struck. We talk about close calls, and you've already described a couple of close calls in the air, but here, out of just the sheer chance of the order in which you get out of the airplane and where you come down, you could have been killed by angry German civilians. Instead, you landed where you were safe.
It was really safe. Then I did notice when I got down that my parachute was fastened on both sides, and I don't know. I had some help there.
So you have no idea how that other side got fastened?
No, it was done.
Well, you talk about somebody looking out for you. That's a pretty clear indication. But that said, while you didn't suffer the fate that your crewmates did suffer, it was no picnic what you did endure. Where did they take you, and how were you treated?
Well, the SS takes you first to interrogation, and they're the worst of all the German soldiers. The Luftwaffe soldiers were really treated as well, but the SS was terrible. And we were taken to a schoolhouse. It was a pretty big battle that day. A lot of planes shot down, and we filled the schoolhouse with about 8 to 10 flyers. And two of them were shot really bad, and we tried to help them as much as we could, but the Germans would give them no help for the first 2 or 3 days. And we were in this schoolhouse, all of us together, and an incident happened there that I'll never forget. The soldier guarding us, he was a Wehrmacht soldier. He wasn't real bad. He left to fill up his canteen with water once and left us there, and he locked the door and everything, but he left us by ourselves. And luckily, or unlucky for him, he was eating his lunch at the time, and when he got back, his lunch had disappeared. He says, who's ate my lunch? And nobody said a word, but at least we had a little snack there.
And you didn't have to pay any punishment for that?
No, the German guard, they were halfway civilized. We were gone the next day. The Luftwaffe took us in and interrogate us and see where we were from and all that. And then they threatened to keep us until we told them where we were from and what we were bombing and everything. And we knew that all we had to tell them was name, rank, and serial number. And you tell them that, and that was it. And they were going to keep me in there for this cell we went to, had a single cell, and we were going to have to stay there until we told them that. And they had an air raid that day on the town. I think it was Regensburg or something. And I watched this air raid from my cell window, the bars, and it was quite a sight. You know, I was a 19-year-old second lieutenant, and nothing I could tell them that they didn't already know. And so I was only there 2 days. And then they sent me to Stalagluft 3, which was their permanent camp for American officers. And there was quite a movie made about Stalagluft 3.
And that's one of my favorites, The Great Escape. What a classic that is.
When I arrived at the camp, I realized that the camp was ran like an army base. We had a colonel was the head of our base, and it was run very strict. If you wanted to escape, you had to go to the escape committee and tell them your plans and everything and wait. But not many people tried that because it was pretty well guarded.
And what were the conditions like there at Stalagluft 3 in terms of what you had to eat, how your, you know, existence was? Did you lose a lot of weight? What was that ordeal like?
Yes, it was something that was expected, I think. The Germans had no food to give you. The American Red Cross served us what we call parcels, and we were supposed to have one parcel a week. Well, we were on a half partial a week, and later, after the war, we found out that the Germans had the other half. But we got by with that. Breakfast would be a slice of German bread. It was sliced about an eighth of an inch thick, but it was very heavy. It had a lot of sawdust in it. In fact, I learned later the recipe, they called it sawdust.
Tree flour? I've heard tree flour before, too.
Tree flour, that was it. It was tree flour. And the bottom of the loaves had, you could see the sawdust in them. But it was very filling. And then at noon, we'd have part of the Red Cross parcel had Spam in it. And we'd try and have a slice of Spam with the piece of bread. Sometimes the Germans would serve us soup. And their soup was a real miss, stretching the name of soup. If you had sauerkraut, it was the sauerkraut that had been boiled and all the goodies taken out of it, and they served you what was left. And vegetable soup was the same way. It would help fill you up. Then at night we'd have part of the Red Cross food. It might have been Spam and cheese and chocolate bar. And they did serve, it had coffee in it too.
You probably would not be surprised to hear that Dean Whitaker lost 40 pounds in his 6 months as a prisoner of war. But what about his liberation? We'll hear that glorious element of his story, as well as how he met the woman he spent 72 of his 97 years married to. I bet you haven't heard a twist quite like this before. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.